Welcome back to Yin and Yang, the podcast. This is James, aka Young. I'm joined here with my co-host Dan, aka Yin, and I'm here with Aileen Cho, drama therapist, marriage counselor, and all-around awesome person. Thank you for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Yay! Good to be here. Yay! Thanks for having me.
Yeah, definitely. Just a quick intro for Aileen. First of all, we met at UCSD. We were part of the first Asian American theater festival.
That's right.
That was, you know, many years ago. And she is a licensed professional offering psychotherapeutic services in both English and Korean. She is a second generation Korean American cisgender female clinician licensed in the state of California. Right. And and today we'd love to like talk to you about your background, your work, and we were just chatting offline again about how you're taking the time for doing this. We really appreciate it because you are in you're in the midst of a busy season for you, right?
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was telling Dan I have a 3.5-year-old, and then the second baby's coming in 2 months. So wow. He caught me at a good time.
Okay. But we really appreciate you coming on and doing this. Yeah.
So,
I mean, to start, So start off, how are you feeling today? How's it going?
Oh, we're doing a check-in.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
I'm very pregnant, very tired. I was saying like, I feel like my brain is shrinking, which they say actually does happen. So that's validating that I'm not just losing it, but, I don't know if your wife, if Jennifer had the same experience,
yes.
But that last trimester, it's just like, I can't find words. I'm forgetting things. The mom brain has kicked in. This is like a happy distraction. I think I'm really, glad to be here. And I was telling James that I checked out a few episodes just to kind of get the vibe. And I just thought it was so wonderful. To see two Asian American men hold space for each other, to talk about like really, serious, vulnerable, intimate things. And also not like, it was just, I thought it was really sweet, the relationship that you two have.
Oh,
so
thank you.
Like,
yeah.
Perfect. Perfect. First podcast.
Cool. Oh yeah. So, for our listeners, this is, Aileen's first podcast. So we are so happy to have her on. And, I know I was just telling her that, for guests, Dan and I, we have groups, we have our social circles that we try and reach out to. And it's very interesting to see the trajectory, how people from where we first met them, so I met Aileen, as I mentioned, in theater and as an actress, as an actor. And it's interesting to see her trajectory into like drama therapy, which makes sense given her your theater background. And also into like clinical practice in therapy. So, and I personally found like, oh, that's super interesting. Cause for myself, I've always been interested in like psychology. And I was always thinking like in a different life, maybe I would have a career in that path, maybe school counselor or something like that. Cause I do find that work, or I really respect the work that you do and your peers do in the field. So, Yeah. So to get it started, sorry, Dan, did you have anything or do you want to add?
No, no. Yeah. We can keep on going here and try to figure out more about Aileen's background and how she got to where she's at.
Yeah. So before we start, let's go to the past. Let's talk about your background a little bit. I only know you mainly from like, our interactions in college, but we didn't really get to speak too much about like, your upbringing or like where you came from, where you come from. So yeah, like, we'd like to hear about
how
that.
Back? Yeah. How way back?
I mean, where were you, born and raised? I guess let's start there.
Yeah. So let's see, I'll go back and share my background that I think will relate kind of to where I've ended up or my path or how it's sort of influenced me. So I was born in Los Angeles, first American born child of my immigrant family. But what's unique about that is that my mother's side of the family were North Korean refugees during the war. So they're like blood, and their hometown is North Korea. And after they fled, my mother was born in the South. She's like number six or five or six. She's a twin on children of seven.
Wow.
And so they fled. My grandmother's, my maternal grandmother. So she fled with her children. From what I know, her entire family never escaped. So it's been a lifelong estrangement. She's passed right. A long time ago. So that family was the family that then immigrated to the US. And I think around the 80s, that was very common, especially for North Koreans, because it was kind of like this mentality of we can't go back home anyway. Like, no, there, you know, like,
yeah,
let's go and find, yeah, if we're going to move to the South, then we might as well go venture out everywhere else. So I think there's a lot, like a big cohort of North Korean, specifically North Korean immigrants around that time, the 80s. And then my father came with my mother, but on my father's side, what's also unique is, or interesting is, he was, I think his father passed really when he was young, and his mother was trying to raise her kids, you know, as a widow. And it was during the Japanese colonial rule. And so he was like kind of sold into this Japanese teacher's home, and essentially was like a child slave until he was legal. So he was also sort of like this kind of translator and cultural broker for like the Japanese home and then like Korea, like the Korean people. Right. So he was fluent in Japanese. And Korean, and then like later Chinese, because I think he then went to China and whatnot. So I'm just sharing this because I think there's a backdrop of intergenerational trauma that I was kind of like born into, as sort of this new, like hopeful generation. Cause I'm also like the first kid that's born in the US when, my mother, her husband, my dad, and, like my mother's side of the family, all like half of the family, immigrated to the United States in the 80s. So growing up, I was like the only kind of, I was like one of those kids where, you know, like when family gathers, like I'm at the adult table, just kind of like listening to what the adults have to say, more than like playing with the kids. And I think my grandmother had a lot of grandchildren, but I, for somehow, like have received a lot of the stories. So I'm sort of like the keeper of like facts and all the rumors and secrets and you know, like I'm the keeper of stories because I just loved listening to her share, or like adults kind of share essentially trauma stories. So I think like I'd like to think that I just was really interested in people at such a young age and stories. And with all the intergenerational trauma, you know, I myself have not really grown up in one place, James. So I think my answer is really long when you say like, oh, where were you born and brought up? Because I was born here, but we ended up moving quite a bit. Like me and my sister were uprooted from like our schools and our wherever we were living quite a bit, because my dad was really trying to find work and like trying to rebuild, and things didn't work out. So I've lived in Korea, and then like plucked from there and lived in like middle of nowhere in Arizona, you know, back in the, like before 2000s. And so the stories of my life and then like sort of my history or my background has a lot of themes around like disconnect and like separation and estrangement, you know, because there's a whole side of the family in the North that they've never had, you know, could reunite or reconnect.
Right.
So bridging has been sort of like a theme of my life, whether it's like bringing people together or bringing oneself to, you know, oneself. And so I think that these were kind of like building blocks that were there before I even considered the career of becoming a therapist or therapy. Truthfully, I did not know that there was a job like I mean, mental health is really hot right now. It's a hot topic, and there's like a lot of movies and shows that show, you know, therapists, but gosh, when I was an undergrad, you're right, I was in theater. I was pursuing that. I wasn't really considering any other career at the time, But what you didn't know was I was in my own therapy for the first time in my life in college. At the same time. So yeah, I was like pursuing theater, acting, and then I was in my own therapy. And I had been given opportunities and like referred to like go to counseling in high school, because there was quite a bit of kind of like family trauma and dealing with mental health issues in my family.
Mm.
And I was like the, you know, I was a high school kid. So I was like, I'm not going to talk to a stranger. And
yeah, yeah.
You know, I don't need therapy. But yeah, my 4 years in UCSD was really colored by the work in theater, of like the power of theater and drama and storytelling, but then being in my own therapy. And I think this is a pretty common thing. People graduate and from college, and it's like your whole life has been kind of structured with, you know, going grade by grade, and then all of a sudden, like, go and
be free,
yeah. Go and be free, be an adult, go and do life. And I was in the industry for like maybe a year. You know, I had an agent. I the last play that I did, Dan, was with your wife. Yeah. The Three Sisters. And I had an opportunity to try out art therapy.
Uh-huh.
And I was like so blown away by this concept of using projection, metaphor, you know, not words, but images. And I think I remember asking the art therapist, like, is there such thing as like drama therapy or theater therapy or psychodrama? And she was like, yeah, actually there is. And I Googled it, and the field must have been like 30 years. So it was like fairly young for a field, you know, that's practicing. Did my research, and I just like, at the time there were two grad schools that were accredited for drama therapy. It was NYU and CIIS, California Institute of Integral Studies in San Francisco. And so, yeah, that was 2010. I pursued my master's degree in drama therapy, and then simultaneously to get licensed to become a marriage and family therapist. Yeah, so that's like my genesis story of yeah. I've ended up in this career. Yeah.
That's amazing. So there's this major separation in your family, then, from what I hear, if I'm correct, it was
my grandmother.
Okay. So that generation, so your mom up, that whole side is you, there was that feeling of a bat. There was there's no reconnection there, you know, cause.
Yeah. I mean, when my grandmother was alive, she thought they would, you know, reopen up the borders and, you know, at the 30th parallel, cause they didn't know it was going to be such a forever thing. And
yeah.
She never got to see, I believe she had like three brothers, and her parents, and yeah. Her whole extended side of North Korea. And when I say intergenerational trauma, what's really interesting is like, that's a forced disconnect, right? Like,
yes,
it wasn't by choice, but
yeah.
What's interesting then to see the next generation is like estrangements happening amongst siblings, or, you know, like amongst
family members.
Cause it's, yeah. Because it's like, how do you, you would think that the connection is so precious and valuable, but also not having like model, like how do you stay in relationship and in connection and in community? When there is this big trauma, this rupture, and a lot of pain and suffering. And so I also see there's also like more immediate kind of cutting off or estrangement I've noticed in within the younger generations.
So
and I think every family has, you know, has these fractured relationship, but I'd like to think there's a connection.
When you say younger generation, are you talking about your generation or
my generation, or even like, yeah, my mom's, her and her siblings, I guess the boomers.
Right.
And then like, or with their children. But I mean, I guess that exists in a lot of families.
Yeah. I mean, that sort of thing happens, but I mean, was it like something specific that happens, or like, was there an incident, or is it just like people just started drifting apart because they lived in different places?
No, like family dramas, you know.
Oh.
That too, the drifting apart. I mean, yeah, they're everywhere, right? Not just in Korea, but anyhow, so, that's been on my mind.
Oh yeah, sorry. So for our listeners who are not familiar with this term intergenerational trauma. Like how would you define it? Or is there like a clinical term for or a clinical definition for it?
Well, the way I like to kind of think about it is that now there's actual research that shows it's not just genetics that get passed on to your children, but especially on, I think because of the caring of the baby, that whatever your grandmother went through while she was, you know, carrying your mother's eggs or your mother, actually, you know, there's genetic markers that show, like what, if trauma has happened or if something traumatic has happened, that there, it does affect the fetus and that that gets passed down.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it's not just like the color of your eyes or your skin that gets passed on, but it's life experiences. I mean, we see this so clearly with the African-American community, right? In terms of post-traumatic, they've coined the term like slave syndrome. But the PTSD gets passed on, but not just with what happened, but I mean, if you have a traumatized generation, I mean, you're a parent, Dan, so you know, but it's like children are such a mirror to what you need to work on, to like your triggers and your buttons.
Yes.
And we have these concepts and terminologies that we can talk about now, but I mean, my parents didn't have the internet. Neither did my grandparents. I mean, there was just no knowledge that your way of rearing children is affected by the way that you, you know, that you were affected, not just in parenting, but I mean, talk about, you know, like really intense collective trauma when you're in survival mode, you know, it's like life or death. You're not going to be attuned and emotionally conscious and, and near your child. So I think there's like a lot that goes, there's a lot of elements that gets funneled into this concept of intergenerational trauma, but it's essentially that, you know, things that happen from one generation does affect the next, unless there's really intentional and conscious work that gets done to heal. And I think that's also why, you know, a lot of millennials and Gen Zs are in therapy, because they're like, holy shit. These boomers and like, you know, generations before had so much trauma, and it we're doing the work to heal and break whatever cycles, unhealthy or toxic cycles of coping that's been passed
I find it pretty amazing that you at such a young age you were able to, you know, recognize, well, I guess first that was, that's the initial resistance of why should I talk to the stranger, but past that you opened yourself up to therapy. I'm curious to like for maybe young people who are listening, like what made you make that choice, or what's advice you would give to someone who would like, oh, maybe I have some issues I need to work through. Should I see a therapist? Or maybe it's not that big of a deal. Maybe I'll just tough it out. Like what for you personally, what was that kind of switch to like, you know what, I need help, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I'm like, how much time do we got today? I mean, there certainly were things that I felt like, I can't handle this on my own. We can call them symptoms, or just feeling like my ways of how I dealt with things is just not working. But I also think that college is a very common time for young folks to go to therapy, because it's you've never left, typically you haven't left your nest of your family of origin, and you're finally like kind of in this life stage of being an independent, you know, adult. But you know, there's like things that maybe needs to be processed or addressed, and you start to see things, you know. I think college is also when you start to kind of think and look back and have perspective or some distance about how you were raised and all the things that have happened up until college. And it's free. Right? Like college mental health, college counseling is like, is accessible. I mean, therapy in general has become way more accessible nowadays. So that's really great. But yeah, I think the space and distance from my family really kind of opened up that window to go, okay, well, like what was that like for me? Or, you know, like, what is my experience? And I think that's especially true for Asian American or Asian folks, where you know, we come from a collectivistic culture where like the group's needs or the group's harmony is more important, right, than my own needs and my own, you know, individual kind of story. So I think that kind of played a role too, that the distance, not living in the home.
Right.
I see. Yeah. And did you have, how were those first steps into therapy? Was it pretty like, oh, you know, this is awesome. Or it's like, you know what, this is not really working for me. I know for myself, yes, I had a resistance to like going to therapy for fear of like being labeling myself as not as there's something wrong with me, I guess. Right.
Mm-hmm, right.
And labeling myself that, oh, you know, I am, you know, there's a lot of conflicting things going on before I sought therapy. But when I eventually did seek out therapy, I did notice that, yes, it was super helpful to have that other like soundboard, talking with someone. And so this is something I talked with Dan about, is that at the end of the day, they cannot solve my problem. They're just helping me process and maybe give me some tools to process these issues that I have in my life. So for yourself, how was that foray into therapy for you? And then I guess obviously it then inspired you, and seeing the art therapy eventually inspired you to your current path, right?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it was so liberating to be able to explore and seek my truth and know that this person wasn't going to judge me or tell me what to do with it. really, like, you know, hold space. I think I've heard you both kind of mention, you know, that terminology. It was liberating. So helpful. And to kind of have my sort of home base where I didn't feel the burden to, like, I don't know, reciprocate or take care of them or wonder about, you know, how they're doing. Especially I call it I don't call it this, but there's like a terminology in Korean, like the Korean eldest daughter syndrome, the K-Tamyo syndrome, where it's like, you're kind of like the second mother hen, you know, taking care of the whole family. And so we can call it people pleasing tendencies, or, you know, like really being in that caretaking mode. It was a really special time to kind of go like, wait a minute, like, what is my experience? What's my truth? I thought that was just so powerful. And then to combine that with, you know, the theater work that we were doing and getting to step into other characters and different stories and tell stories and express myself in ways that I normally, as me in my real world, could not ever or
right.
like that was, it was such a powerful concoction that made me kind of discover a whole new way of being, I think.
Were these therapists, let's get real, were they white or?
Yeah, actually my first therapist was white.
Okay.
She was also a licensed clinical social worker. So I think she always kind of brought in some of the systemic lens. And we're talking, this is like early 2000s. But then my therapist after her, I've been on and off in therapy for over a decade. My second therapist was Korean American.
Oh,
and,
wow.
I think that was rare, and probably another factor into why I felt motivated to get into the field, because there was like no Asian, you know, therapist to begin with, and to have, you know, a Korean American female be my next therapist was also so powerful, you know, helpful and unique. Different than my white therapist, but I've had, I've had white, Asian, mixed, male, female, young, old.
Do you find that having maybe a similar cultural background is helpful? I know you mentioned in your blog post about Asian Americans don't do therapy. That's the title.
Right. Yeah. I know. It's a good one, because people are like, what?
and you do mention that, yes, having that cultural lens, or maybe having someone, I know a friend of mine, she specifically sought out, you know, a woman of color, not necessarily, she's Asian American, but she's like, okay, I'll get the next best scene. Does anyone know a therapist that is a woman of color. And then I think she eventually landed on like a Jewish woman who yeah. who has a lot of Black friends. But basically, regardless of the therapist's race, that person understood, brought some cultural understanding to the her practice. And that was something my friend really appreciated. So there does seem to be a dearth of Asian Americans in your field, you know, the mm-hmm. mental health field. Mm-hmm. Do you think there's a reason for that? Or I know you outlined some reasons why Asian Americans don't do therapy, but yeah, not so many are going into the practice either. Do you see that? Is that still the case, or is that changing?
Huge no. Especially after, I mean, I started to see the numbers grow. I mean, when I was in school, this is 2010. It was only me and one other Asian cohort member in a cohort of 17.
Oh,
let's see. But I mean, and then like when you look up online on Google or Psychology Today, like maybe a handful of or less. And now, I mean, it's pages. Like there's you have so many options. Like it's too many options now, and you can get really specific on, you know, what identities you want your therapist to hold. But the big change that I really truly felt was during the pandemic. Because before then, my practice was always a bit of a mix. And because I speak Korean, you know, I'd have some Korean clients and Asian American clients. But during, I think it was when I came back from my first maternity leave in 2021, I got filled up so quickly, and 99% of my caseload were Asian Americans.
Wow.
And the amount of calls I was getting and my colleagues were getting, it was just, I felt like we were spending more time trying to find referrals for people. And this was specifically after that Atlanta spa shootings.
Oh,
right. It happened during COVID. But I mean, the number of calls was unlike anything I had experienced before in my like private practice career. And since then, I mean, it's not like I only see Asian Americans, but my practice is 100%. All my clients right now are, 95% are.
Wow.
Asian Americans. Yeah. So more people are seeking, and there's more providers, more clinicians, which is great.
And then your clientele mostly being Asian American, are they mostly Korean American, or are they just like,
it's a mix.
Yeah,
mix. And some are mixed race, or sometimes, you know, I see couples. So like one partner is,
right,
you know, and if it's a bicultural couple. So yeah, a good mix.
Mm. Are there specific issues you've seen with your Asian American clients that maybe are specific to Asian Americans that maybe like, basically like for, I know for myself, you mentioned a little bit of that butting of heads between like collectivist identity versus individualistic identity in the West. So like in the East, there's like a this collectivist mentality. And this is something I see with my wife. My wife is Japanese. And I noticed that there's this budding that happens, you know, unconsciously or consciously sometimes.
Totally.
So yeah, is that a common thread, or what are other some common threads that you see with that you can speak to publicly, I guess?
Happy to. I mean, in terms of my, I guess, work experience, I've been on the whole spectrum of kind of mental health severities, meaning like I've worked at inpatient psychiatric units where they're not there by, you know, will. It's not like they signed a consent, but they're on hold from not being able to keep themselves safe or others safe, to residential programs, to partial hospitalization programs, inpatient, and then now like outpatient in my private practice, I would say is like the lightest form in terms of like these people are mostly healthy and well functioning. And I've seen, you know, prominent figures in our society, you know, you know, big CEOs to teens, you know, it's, I think there's not a lack of variety in terms of, you know, not just the ethnic piece, but like where people are coming from and what they do and class and all that. But I think what makes it extra challenging when it comes to any sort of BIPOC communities is that, okay, so you've got the mental health, like the regular mental health stuff that does not discriminate, by the way, right, of any particular group. And then you've got, you know, familial relationship stuff that does not discriminate any particular group. It's just, you know, this is life. This is what happens with humans. We suffer because of relationships. And then you've got, like you say, then like the cultural inner conflicts, but also like familial conflict, intergenerational trauma. So it just really makes things very much more complex. You know, it's like easier said than done to, yeah, just follow these steps or just do this one exercise or use this one approach to change and feel better, you know. I often find Asian American clients having such a strong will or desire for change, but feeling really gridlocked by both systems that they feel trapped in, but also, and I think this is where a lot of white clinicians don't quite fully get that it's not just a choice. You know, the systems that we're in terms of families and relationships is also our lifeline. It's not just something that you can like set a boundary right. And just say no mom or no dad. And I think being able to understand that and then hold that,
right,
just in and of itself, right, that's not a solve, but just to go, there's nothing wrong with you, you know. This is hard. And, you know, and some people do choose to then like, whatever, set boundaries, say no, put distance. But I think it's important to not make it seem so like it's like easy, like it's on the person to just solve these, you know, long and like deeply embedded cultural beliefs and values. And so I've got some like theories that I haven't, they're not written anywhere and they're not coined anywhere, but is it okay if I share like a couple?
Yeah,
of them?
Yes.
Please. Yeah, definitely.
Like, I call it the time capsule theory. And because I have worked with, like, if I'm seeing Koreans or Korean Americans, they're kind of all along the spectrum of like just have immigrated, you know, from Korea to like third generation. I can't speak a lick of Korean, but the Korean is in me. Right. And, I have noticed that parents who have immigrated and have raised their children actually have even more archaic and conservative values that they use to parent their kids than the parents back home. So meaning like if your parents immigrated in the 60s, they're going to operate from values from the 60s. And say, this is the tradition, this is the belief or value that our culture lives by or whatnot. And so you're raising a kid in the 80s with 60s, whatever, Korean values. But then when you actually go look in Korea, like they've continued to live and evolve and are way more progressive. So like, for instance, like my queer clients, right? They're the parents, like there are no gay people. In Koreans, like, actually, no, there's a ton of gay people. They're, you know, they've got an LGBTQ group and, you know, they allow same-sex marriage. So that's sort of like an example, but that there's a time capsule theory. And so like children here are actually brought up with even more outdated ways of parenting and like what their culture, their home culture or their parents' culture is, that it's really sad because there's already a gap in terms of generation, just natural generation. There's the gap with the language. And then now there's this phantom time gap where it's like, I'm living in the 60s at home where, and then I'm having to deal with 80s America or whatever, you know?
Yes.
And so I just, which leads me to the next point, which is not my theory, but like, a lot of times in therapy, the work is, here's the map of the world that I've been given. And the actual world that I'm living in day to day today, there's such cognitive dissonance. Like this is not matching, like none of the signs are updated, none of the roads are, you know, and to recalibrate, right? Like, okay, like what are some of the things from the old map that I've been given that I can hold on to because it's a part of who I am and my identity, my culture. And then like, what is really working and not working for me right now in terms of, you know, how to live my life, how to make life choices, how to be. And so I think unpacking that, that's something that I've noticed working with Asian Americans the disconnect. I also do family therapy. So, you know, when I'm doing like parent and children work, it's literal language miscommunication, right?
Yeah.
And then also the time piece and the value piece. And and so to go back to the bridging, like I love the work of getting, you know, two parties to take conflict and then turn it into kind of deeper understanding and connection with each other. Because they both want the same thing. We all want the same thing, right? We all want to be understood,
right?
To connect. And
yeah,
there's just so many things that like fucks it up.
Yeah, for sure.
When you have the family therapy sessions, have you ever had a family with a boomer generation and our generation?
Yes.
Oh,
many, many, so many.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, that's interesting.
That's interesting.
I don't think, so many.
Yeah, the boomer generation, our parents' generation, I don't think I can never imagine them going to therapy, and they are the ones who totally need it, but they're the ones who are the most opposed to it.
They'll be like, yeah. What? $200? What? Are you crazy?
Stranger to like tell me what to do?
Do you know how much cabbage I can buy? How much groceries I can buy with that? You know, like, yeah.
Year-long kimchi. Yeah, that's like year-long kimchi supply right there.
Yeah.
A hack or a tip for the listeners to get boomer parents into therapy is if it's about you. I think they're so centered around the children doing well or being well, that if it's like about you needing help,
yeah,
that often gets them through the door,
right?
And then if you have a good therapist who really understands that generation and can like talk to them, then like I think the trust gets built there. But yeah, never if it's about them. Like they don't need
they don't need it. Well, they don't need therapy.
Yeah, they don't think they need therapy.
And have you in your practice, have you found that it's helped you personally in your own life? Like is there like you personally seek therapy yourself, right?
Yes.
Yes. And then you also, I know for like Dan and I, we teach martial arts, and as a teacher, we learn martial arts from teachers, but when we teach it, it seems that we incorporate those lessons, or like, wait, am I actually practicing this? You know, like I'm teaching it, but am I walking the walk? Right.
Right.
So have you found that, you know, from learning and from taking therapy and also being a therapist yourself, has that improved your life? Like in your relationships in your family?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, yes. And I always tell my clients that when it comes to other people in our lives, like, we can't change them. You know, you can only change yourself. So I also, yes, it's helped me, but I also know the limitations of therapy. It's not like a absolute cure all. And, you know, and not every family therapy or couples therapy is a success story. In our field in our field, there's also this, you know, because we're trained, but also we have like legal and ethical responsibilities, it's also important to not take on cases or issues that you probably have a lot of like bias in because right, the first thing is like do no harm, and right. Also if you're for whatever reason, if it's an uncomfortable topic for you, if it's something you're going through in the moment with your client, you're probably not the best person to be in like the helping role. So the fancy term we use is counter transference, but it's like our own personal feelings about the client or whatever issues that they're bringing in. Something to kind of always kind of be aware of knowing what my limitations and boundaries are. But, you know, I have colleagues that I consult with. Supervision has ended once I got licensed, but you know, we're always kind of having to really look at ourselves and go like, is this a case that I can actually help and am equipped to, you know, handle, is what I wanted to add to your question.
And how and sorry if this is too personal, let me know, but like how has marriage been for you, and then eventually from marriage to I'm a newlywed myself.
Congratulations.
And, thank you very much, and the both of you are further along than I am as far as you know, but I'm curious to hear how marriage was for you, how marriage is for you, and then eventually motherhood.
gosh, the I think what I wanted to add from the previous question to this to kind of like segue is that like for instance during COVID, right? Like where we were all going through it. And when I say all, like the therapists were going through it too at like the same time. Right. So for instance, like if I was going through a divorce right now, I would probably be self-advising and advice from colleagues to not work with couples on the brink of divorce because I'm deep within it personally. But COVID was a whole, probably a unique circumstance that has never happened before where therapists, the providers were also in it with, you know, the clients and like, as we're giving reassurance in the back of our minds, we're like, I don't know. Are we okay? Is this going to be okay? Like, I don't know, okay? You know, like people around me. Yeah. Are we okay? Like, you know, people around me and my personal life are dying too. And, am I equipped to help? But, yeah, the marriage piece, we've been married for, this is our fourth year. We'll be in our fifth anniversary. thank you. In September, but I think we got pregnant real fast. So it was almost like marriage and baby happened so quickly.
Oh, wow. Congratulations.
Yeah. And
people try for years. Yeah.
I know. That's what we thought too. We were like, oh, you know, everyone around us is like, fertility is like really hard. So we should, you know, get on it. And then it was just like,
bam.
Bam. Exactly. So, it was hard. I mean, we were together before we got married for, I don't know, like 4-5 years, you know, living together. We were, you know, a couple. Yeah, and then marriage happened with a kid. So when you ask me going into year 5 soon of how marriage has been, like so, so hard.
Oh.
Because even when we track like marital satisfaction, like on a graph, with different life stages and things like that happen, you know, and it's like this. And then as soon as you add the first kid, the pin drops off the graph.
Oh, wow.
Like, it's like, it's no longer even on the graph.
Wait, where is this graph? Is it on the internet?
We could try to find it. That is how hard adding a child is on a marriage, on a couple.
Wow.
So my answer is a little complicated. It's not that marriage has been hard. It's just that marriage happened, baby happened, and it was a COVID baby. He was born in 2020.
Right.
We didn't even have support. Like we couldn't even have support because we were quarantined. So I don't think my marriage was hard. I think the circumstances that our marriage was, started off, it was hard. But
that's tough. Yeah. Especially during COVID. Yeah. So then you can't. You can't have the grandparents come in and like take care of
no
baby.
One.
Yeah. Wow.
No one. I mean, he was luckily able to be there when I gave birth, but it was tough.
Oof. Yeah.
And why it took so long for us to decide on having another one. We have to keep telling ourselves like, it's not COVID anymore.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You made it through.
Yeah. But do you have specific questions about marriage?
Yeah. I think for your husband, does he come from a similar cultural background or not necessarily? No.
Filipino American, doesn't speak a lick of Tagalog.
Oh.
Born and raised in one place down in San Diego.
Oh, okay.
So
oh,
I mean,
dance?
You know.
Yeah.
Oh, Dan?
Dan's huh? San Diego what? Guy. Yeah.
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 Oh. Wow, San Diego and Bay Area. We have like two points of connection. Well, yeah. Now you're in LA.
I'm in LA. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm in LA right now too.
I'm in Japan, so I'm disconnected.
Disconnected, estranged.
Estranged, yes, yes. So I guess specific questions about marriage. One was like, so coming from different cultural backgrounds, kind of segueing from like, so even though that you and your husband have different cultural background, you're still both Asian American. So there is there is some thread there, I guess, right? I know for myself, I don't know if you work with international couples or couples with very different backgrounds. Do you see sometimes there's like the abutting of heads, and maybe there are certain tools or resolutions that you've discovered in your practice? Yeah.
I mean, absolutely. Even if you come from the exact same culture and have the exact same upbringing, you're naturally going to have conflict. And I think what's really interesting about couples is that it's a choice, right? You've chosen this other person as your partner. You know, you said, yes, I do. It wasn't like when we're born into a family where it's like, I didn't ask for this. And so there, you know, the bond is that we're coming together to be one unit. So I think what disturbs partners and couples, and I resonate, is that when there is some sort of a disagreement, like when we don't align, it's like really disturbing. It's like, but I chose you because I love you and I want you and I want to be together. But what, you don't agree with, you know, how I live or, you know, how we're going to go about this. So that's already baked in to couples, no matter what. So then you add, the not just culture in terms of like you say, your wife is Japanese and you're Taiwanese, right, James?
I'm Taiwanese American.
Taiwanese American, yeah. Not just that, but I mean, not just like the ethnic differences, but each family has very different values. And when I say culture, I'm kind of like using that like across the board, not just ethnic background. So yeah, I have front row seats to intimate and vulnerable details of what couples are fighting about and struggling with in our modern day and age.
Would you say maybe communication is maybe the main issue there? Like misunderstanding, like I say A, but it's perceived as B, like
absolutely.
Why? Yeah. So like resolution. I'm wondering, I saw that you work with the Gottman theory method.
And some of that.
Yeah. Some of that. So I saw that. I was like, oh, maybe I'll check out the book. So because I wonder, it's like maybe my own, or so let's say in general sense, like not to maybe certain couples is stuck in certain modes of thinking, and they think they are, their worldview is correct,
of course, yeah,
and I'm right. Why is this person,
I'm always right,
James. Yeah, why is this person not on the program, right? They're not getting on my program, right? And then
if they love me, they need to get on board,
right? So I guess so where is that place of compromise for communication for couples? Like if you were going to give like advice on like communication between couples, let's give an example. For instance, maybe this couple's going on a vacation, and then, they're going on vacation to go see some family, right? And then maybe one person is like, you know what? I want to stay a little bit longer with my family. Why don't you head back home, wherever home is, first, and I'm going to stay. But then the other person's like, wait, are we not going as a couple, going and coming back together? Stuff like that. You know, there's different value ideas. I wonder how do you work through something with a couple going through something similar like that? Yeah. It could be something mundane or bigger. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. They bring in like concrete stuff in all the time. And we all fight about the same things, or, you know, couples will have the like a recurring fight, the fight that they always have over and over and over again. But I mean, when it comes down to communication, we think we're good. All of us think we're good listeners, myself included. And we are the worst listeners when it comes to the people that we live with. You know, and so that's a big thing, like learning true listening skills. And because we are constantly with the people that we live with, I'm going to say not just couples, but you know family, we get kind of lazy in terms of really being curious about the certain questions or the certain comments that they are always saying. Because, you know, I have conversations in my head of, I could literally write out a script of like how a certain dialogue will go with me and my husband. Mm-hmm. Right. But like, how often do we kind of stop and go, wait, well, I'm curious. Like, he keeps mentioning this one word or this one phrase. Like, what is that really about? Like, what is that what's the intention? If we're going back to kind of theater work, where is that stemming from? But as a clinician, when people are bringing in concrete issues, like that kind of more specific disagreement, and we really get into weeds of what happened and how are we going to work it out, you kind of miss the whole, you miss the more important picture of what's going on. But I mean, Marriage, yeah. So if there's anyone that I really look up to as sort of like the guru of couples therapy, but also just generally of mental health, is Esther Perel. I don't know if
Perel. Oh,
that's a name that is familiar. Oh my gosh, big fan of her. But she talks a lot about how much marriage and what it is and what it is meant for has changed in just a generation or two. In the history of mankind, that is that right now in our today, partners are being asked of so much, that there's so many expectations that are being placed on the couple. Because even family therapy, it never started with the couple. Couples therapy is probably the youngest constellation and like approach in the field of therapy. Because family therapy really started with treating children. It was like the children were having issues, right, and then they're in the family and you're looking at the whole constellation. But yeah, I think the expectations from our partners, or the expectations that we have on our partners, is what's really making or breaking couples. You know, because back in the day, marriage meant it was for survival, and it was for economic reasons, really, right? To have children, to buy property, to then have a family of your own, your community.
Right,
and that was
right.
it. And roles and expectations were very clear, especially because religion was also heavily involved, right? Everyone knew what to do. Everyone knew what their place was. Everyone knew what tasks were expected of them. And then she goes into much more detail about sort of the timeline, but then it's like marrying for love happens. Most famous book is called Mating in Captivity. I highly recommend. It sounds like it's just all about sex, but it's far from it. It's really about eroticism in the sense of like life force, not just sex, but so romanticism. And then there's the oh my gosh, mom brain has kicked in.
Okay.
The economy, it's the service economy. So what can this person do for me? And this is where a lot of couples get caught up of like, well, I'm doing this and you're not doing this, and you know, the fights about what they're giving to you as a partner. And this also goes hand in hand with sort of this like capitalistic consumer culture, right? Like we click and you know, we buy the thing, and then if it doesn't do the thing, then we're going to return it. It's like what I signed up for. So expectations there, but then now the generation that we're entering, she says, is the identity economy. So not only is this person supposed to be someone I'm supposed to like be in love with, have amazing sex with, have children with, build a life together, but they also need to like make me the best version of myself.
Yeah.
So meaning like they have to be my best friend, my therapist, my confidant, my, you know, we do everything together. Like they're my everything. And nowhere in history has one person been able to fulfill an entire village for anyone, you know? So when expectations are that high, it's like a natural setup for resentment and couples feeling like I didn't sign up for this. This is not what I envisioned or fantasized or what we promised to each other at the podium. Divorce rates are high.
But then would the solution be low expectations or like?
I don't think it's lower expectations. I think it's realistic expectations, because it sounds like a lot of the things that are influencing our expectations are media and movies and romance and
social media,
books and stuff like that. Because those are just, I mean, it sounds like we have, our generation especially, we grew up on TV and movies, and then we see all these things that like what a perfect couple is supposed to be like on film. And then when we get there, it's not exactly that way. And then we get let down by those expectations that are unrealistic. And those are all fiction. It's mostly based on fiction.
Yeah, that someone's written out. And the other thing, Dan, I'm remembering is that in one generation, so our parents' generation, they used to get married really young, like their 20s. And so we had nothing. And the concept was, we're going to build a life together.
Right.
We're going to start from nothing. We're going to build. Now we're like, that's crazy. If we see anyone graduate from high school and college and get married, we're like, what? Because now the model is, you're going to be the best version of yourself, have financial security, or maybe have a house by then at the pinnacle of your career. And then you're going to find your soulmate who has the exact same thing. But guess what? Like, marriage is reality. And once that kind of, wait, but this is the climax of our lives. Like, yeah. Cannot sustain, you know, like, why can't we just, you know, keep going higher from here? That's another set of, I think, unrealistic fictional expectations that our generation has put upon ourselves. Mm. And like, not settling for right. less. And it's like, what does that even mean? Because at the end of the day, we're all flawed. No one's perfect. We're all a work in progress.
Yes.
And that change is very unusual in human history. If you're looking at change and what like values or cultures or models for living have changed, is so drastic.
Mm. Right. I find that so interesting.
Yeah,
service economy, identity economy, and
she calls it the identity economy.
Yeah, and you see that play out also in like in our social media nowadays of people, you know, a lot of, like you mentioned, like a lot of self-help, a lot of people seeking out mental health, which is good. But then I think there's this unrealistic expectation of, oh, this partner will fulfill that hole,
that
gaping hole in my identity or my sense of self. But that's not the case. So yeah, we're coming up about an hour. So we'd like to, you know, end with a dance. Sorry, did you have anything else you wanted to add? Or yeah.
Oh, I just a couple things. Have you thought about while it's still fresh in your mind, probably after your kid, documenting the stories of your family, and then the second thing is like the time capsule theory, somewhat adjacent to it, not completely the same. But I was speaking with a friend, and her family immigrated from Vietnam at a certain age, mm-hmm. and then. Now their Vietnamese is actually locked into that time period when they left. Right. When they go back, it's actually the phrasing is different, intonations are a little bit different. So it's something similar to what you're thinking about or talking about. And this sounds like a great opportunity for you to write a book. Just saying.
Time, I think too. Yeah, start writing a book, right?
Yeah.
I love that. Yeah, that's exactly it. And I think so many of our immigrant communities, like isolation is a big theme, right?
Right.
And to go back home and to feel further isolated, I don't know. I just feel like a deep kind of collective sadness and some grief there. Like where do they belong, or where do they feel home at home? Mm. To your first question, there's so many modalities of drama therapy, but there's a section where there's performances.
Yes.
Like kind of therapeutic performances. So I have archived some family history, in the form of performances.
It's great.
That's awesome. Yeah. I studied a little bit about psychotherapy when I was working on the Cho Show. I was a performer in that. David Cho, he's an artist in LA. I that's a whole nother podcast is talking about drama therapy, I think. Yeah. But I do find
I'll do
it
another part two.
Yeah, yes. That'd be great. Yeah, yeah. So we did something. I'm not trained, by the way. But as part of the art show, we had participants, you know, share a little bit about their history, and also we would act out some of that history, you know, in a play space or in a so I just found it, you know. Yeah, it's a lot of unpacking that's happening. A lot of stuff is going on there. But having a safe space, as you mentioned in your blog about drama theory, having a safe space to play, adults playing, mm-hmm. I think that's great. And giving, I guess, maybe some distance to that traumatic event some of those events that still, you know, trouble us. But giving that distance or that space to play with it, I do think is super important. Yeah. So let's moving on to our next section would be... So we're called yin and yang, so kind of like yin and yang.
Yeah.
So what are some things that you're doing nowadays to, like, you know, keep balanced with your life? I know it's a lot of stuff to juggle. You're on your second pregnancy.
I
you
know.
have your practice, and then and your husband.
I was like, what is balance during the season of my life? Does that even exist?
Right. Well, yeah, maybe doesn't, maybe that's the balance, is that this perfect balance doesn't exist. I don't know. Yeah.
I love that you asked the question, because it made me kind of think, like, what do I do? And you said daily, because I feel
Yeah,
like
I'll
there
tell
are
you.
things I do to, you know, in like a month to like balance out everything. But I was like, what do I do on the day to day? It probably doesn't happen all the time, but, you know, like sometimes my work gets really heavy, obviously, because I'm, you know, dealing with trauma. And so I, especially on my work days and, yeah, especially on my work days, I really try to at least have one moment where there's something light or funny or playful, whether it's, you know, watching something, but mostly with connections. So I'll like text a friend or call a friend, or, you know, and there's plenty of lightness and playful moments with my 3.5-year-old, but I make it, you know, they're such, it's a fun age. I love this age so much. So that kind of happens naturally. I don't think I have to like be so intentional about it, but you know, it's like when you take medicine and you know it's medicine, it does a better job. So I go, right, like this is my kind of healing balm for the day. And the other thing I have, I have been trying to do is talk to someone. And I really mean like call or meet up with someone. And that's why I don't think it happens every day, but with someone that's not in my age cohort. Because that's a rare thing nowadays to be in kind of multi-age families or multi-generational families or communities. So that naturally happens with my 3.5-year-old,
right.
You know. But yeah, like to really seek out people, even like I'm a millennial, so, you know, have Gen Z friends or my Gen X friends and or a boomer, just talk to someone that's not in my age bracket, kind of shake up things for me, because I can really kind of get in my head about what's going on with me and this life stage. And, you know, of course I have my mom friends and my therapist friends, but we're all, you know, in the same cohort. So I think that's something I try to do, to mix it up.
So kind of getting outside of your echo chamber, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. In one way too. Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. All right. And then our next, well, our last question is our language corner. Yay.
Hey.
So a language corner is basically a phrase or something that maybe we're learning in another language. One thing I've been hearing a little bit more of, I haven't seen Past Lives yet with Tao Yu. He was a previous guest on this podcast. Have you seen it yet?
On my list? No, it's on top of my list. That's the thing I need to watch next.
Yeah. So they talk about, I think I'm trying to see if I... What's the Korean? I know in Chinese, it's called yuanfen. Yuanfen is kind of like, some people, sometimes it's translated as destiny or fate. But my understanding of it, when I was speaking to, you know, Taiwanese people, Chinese people about it, it's more about like circumstances. Like this is how things came together. In English, we say fate or destiny, but there's a certain like gridlocked sensation when you say those words, for me at least, when I say those English words. But yuan fen is more like those things just came together. So like, for instance, my wife and I, we met in Taiwan, and we just say to each other, oh, that's yuan fen, you know, like it was during COVID. I wanted to get out of the U.S. There's a lot of stress I was having in the U.S. during the pandemic, because anti-Asian hate and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I got out, and she was in Taiwan for like getting out, like she needed a break from like the Japanese work ethic, the work culture. And so we came together and met at this time. So this culmination of events and circumstances led us together. And that we call that yuan fun. I think in Korean, correct me if I'm wrong, let me find it. Is it like
yin yang?
Yin yang. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yin yang. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like destiny.
There's destiny, or like, circumstances brought us together, something like that. So that's my
past lives, right? Like you've had to meet many, many, many times to then also meet in this lifetime.
Oh, that's romantic.
Part of the theory.
Yeah, past life, Yeah, so finally we met in this life. So yeah, any phrases that you both are fond of or learned recently?
Yes. I've actually been nerding out about it. So it was so funny that you asked that question. I was like, oh my gosh, great opportunity to kind of nerd out about it. I was in Hong Kong. I do some teaching there, and
Oh,
I
wow.
went this year I went in person after COVID, first time since COVID. I have some good colleagues there, and I do some teaching of drama therapy. And so when I'm there, I'm an English speaker, so I need a lot of translation.
Yes.
And I think it was the word, how do you say empathy in Chinese? Do you know?
Tong tong qing. So tong is means same, qing means
Is
like
that Mandarin?
feeling. That's Mandarin though, yeah.
So Cantonese. I'm pretty sure this like occurred in during this time. So I don't know. I don't, yeah, we'd have to find it out in
Cantonese.
Cantonese, but
Cantonese.
empathy is kong kam in Korean. Kong kam.
Kong kam.
And then I had to look up empathy because I thought it was Latin and it wasn't. It was actually Greek. In Greek, it's in pathos. So pathos is feeling, but the in is in, like internal. So it's a feeling within. So it's kind of very much self-focused, which is interesting because when we use the word empathy or be empathetic or have empathy, it's like in relation to. But what's interesting in Korean, kong kam, is that kong is the same character for like shared or communal. It's the same kong. I don't have the inflection probably in Chinese, but it, and then kam is feeling. So it's like this shared feeling. It's a collective feeling that has to be in relation to another person. And I was like, how perfect is that, that in this basic word that we throw around so much, especially in therapy, kind of full circling back to that whole collectivistic versus individualistic way of being and values, that even in empathy, that yeah, ours is really much based on kind of community, the group or others in relation to, and that the Western definitions, the root of it is actually to be like in touch within.
That's so interesting,
Yeah,
yeah.
I
And
know.
it's not like one is better than the other. It's just a different modality. It's different models, right? Yeah, I
Different
mean,
roots of what the
roots.
meaning is, but we actually use it in the same way. We use the like the word similarly with this notion of like put yourself in another person's shoes or feel what the other person is feeling. So
I think
yeah.
this is yeah,
Yeah, the Kong, I think when
gong
I Google translated, it's that.
gong gan. Gong is
Kong Kong.
like gong is like it's the same character as like Gong Chang Dan, the like Communist Party. So
Oh yeah,
gong,
exactly. The Kong. Yeah, if
and
Kong
then,
had a Kong, the root is calm, like communal, community, common, shared.
common, calm, gong. Oh, interesting. That's so interesting. And
Kong Yan is like concerts because we're like listening together
as a group,
as a group.
So yeah, the language is so interesting because I've heard before Cantonese and Korean have a lot of like there's some stuff going on there, like linguistically, a lot of similarities. Cool.
That's
Oh,
Kong Gan.
and thank you for sharing that. Eileen shared
The
the Korean.
Korean spelling, yeah,
Oh,
for
awesome.
empathy. And
Empathy.
there's separate words for like feelings and emotions, but that's specifically the direct translation of empathy. So I'd be
Wow,
curious to know
awesome.
what it is in like Japanese
Oh,
and
yeah.
Vietnamese, yeah.
I'll look it up and put in the show notes. I like to geek
Great.
out about that stuff too. Dan, do you have anything before we end?
I don't have a word for this week or this podcast.
No worries. I think Japanese, empathy. I
Ask
know.
your wife.
I can ask my wife. I know for like the Japan, like a lot of, because kanji comes from China, and so there's a lot of like overlap with like the Chinese characters used in Japanese, and the same having similar or the same meaning in Chinese. So tong maybe tongqing, or I'll look into it. But
Fun.
so Aileen, thank you so much for being our guest today. It was such a pleasure speaking with you, and thank you for sharing all
Yeah, thanks for
your
listening.
knowledge with us today.
This
Is
is fun.
your mom still making kimchi, by the way?
Oh, no, we make it.
Oh, you make it.
Yes, she's given us the, has Jennifer told you her kimchi?
No, I remember I looked it up on Facebook and you were selling it at one point and I asked you about it.
Yes.
And you, it was like, it was because you were in the Bay Area and now we were already down
Yes.
here. And I was like, hey, I kind of want some kimchi.
My husband makes it. It's my mother's recipe. We make my mom's kimchi, and that's one of our, like, I guess, like, every other
Finances.
month way to be balanced, stay balanced.
Yeah.
We'll give you kimchi.
Well, do you also do the radish one too?
I don't. I like it. I don't know why we don't. No, we just kind of stick to the same, like, ritualistic
Napa, yes.
cabbage. Yeah. But
Okay,
my mom's
awesome.
like two secret ingredients goes in it.
Oh,
So good.
wow.
Okay.
Yeah, I guess
Deal.
where can people find you? And I mean, you're not accepting new clients until September, I saw. Okay. But
Yeah,
if people
everyone's.
want to know more about your work and like get more information, I guess your website, is that the best place?
Yes.
Okay, so
And they email
please.
me in the next month. They can say hi.
Yeah.
After a month, I'm gonna have my away message. But yeah, and then my email. Yeah. Fun,
So
fun.
yeah, for our listeners, please go to if you want to get more information about Aileen, sorry,
Aileen.
Aileen, please go to aileenbcho.com. So that's spelled AileenBcho.com. That's where you can find her work, and she has some great blogs that you can check out as well, talking about a lot of things that we've mentioned today. Also, you can email her at aileen@aileenbcho.com. So that's aileenbcho.com. And thank you so much. And yeah, I guess be well, be balanced, be healthy, and we'll talk soon.